Die beeld is er.
Will. The title derives from Liddy's explanations of how he strengthened his will and overcame his fears. You've probably heard stories about one of his ways of strengthening his will, holding lip matches to his flesh without flinching or withdrawing. Liddy was in the Army and the FBI and became an assistant DA before moving to Washington, D.C. in 1969 to join the Treasury Department. He became the finance counsel for the Committee to Re-elect the President, where he organized the Watergate break-in, designed to bug the Democratic National Committee headquarters. Liddy was sentenced to 20 years in prison. In 1977, President Carter commuted his sentence to 8 years, and he was released in September of 1977 after serving 4.5 years. Liddy is known for his loyalty and stamina and refusal to give information. However, I believe the statute of limitations is running out on his offenses, so he's discussing some of this in his book, Will. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. Actually, all the statute of limitations have run out, and so I was able to discuss it all without reservation in the book. And there's no possibility that anybody's liberty these days can be endangered. So there's nothing more that I know that I have not put in the book. It's all there.
Is that the reason why you wrote the book?
Not exactly. The fact of the matter is that had I been successful in the containment strategy, which was to try to preserve President Nixon's term to its normal end, I never would have addressed these things at all. But of course, that was overtaken by events. And thereafter, I was offered my freedom if I would give up my friends, but of course I wouldn't do that. But Stuart Alsop, the late Stuart Alsop, who was a columnist and a fine one and had been an OSS agent in World War II and for whom I had a lot of respect, especially because of the way the man handled his own death, first in 1973, that early, said to me, "You have a debt to history." And since that time, an awful lot of people said the same thing, and I took the position, well, okay, I've got a debt to history. I'm a primary source, but nowhere on the note does it say payable at such time when to do so would put at risk the liberty of former associates. So I waited until all the statutes of limitations had run out so that I could do it. Because the last time when I was on a book tour, I wrote a novel which had nothing to do with me or Watergate. Nobody wanted to talk about that. They all wanted to talk about me or Watergate, and I couldn't. And I told him at the time that, you know, when the time came, I would, and I've kept that promise. And when I write my next book, which I anticipate will also be fiction and a novel, and I come around again, I hope then I'll be able to talk about the novel, you know, rather than Watergate.
I'd just like to mention that we'll be opening up the telephones in a little while on Fresh Air, so if you have any questions, you'll be able to phone them in. What impression do you hope to leave readers with?
Well, I don't want to presume to instruct the reader as to what impressions or what conclusions they should draw. What I do hope is that they will read the book rather than excerpts and condensations from Time magazine or other things, because this book I put a lot of work on, and it is my best shot at presenting what happened and my reasons and everything else. And if someone reads this through and through, then I've had my say, and they are perfectly entitled to draw whatever conclusions they want. I've made my best effort.
What conclusions would you want someone to draw? What impression would you like your readers to have of you and of your reasons for your
actions? Well, I would say just, you know, it's hard to sum a thing like that up, but if I must, I would say just somebody who did what he was supposed to do when he was supposed to do it, did not do what he wasn't supposed to do when he wasn't supposed to do it. And when I was in the Army, they gave out medals for conduct above and beyond the call of duty. And I don't really feel that I've done anything above and beyond. All I did was what I was supposed to.
So you'd like your image to be someone who was following their call of duty and doing their best in the service of their country and their president?
Yeah, but always bearing in mind that I don't believe in blind obedience. I believe in individual responsibility and freedom of the will and the supremacy of conscience. And I did not and would not do anything which did not accord with those. And I'm also a believer that, you know, when you do something that you think you ought to do and you know it's illegal, and I knew it was illegal, just as the, what do they call them, civil protesters or whatever,
civil disobedience people,
if they wanted to do that, that was fine. But I didn't have any respect for those who then, when they were caught or prosecuted for it, proceeded to snivel. And so I should not be heard to carry on about what occurred in my case. I was perfectly willing to accept whatever the positive benefits might have been from my courses of action, and I was perfectly willing to accept and did accept the negative ones when something went wrong. And I just think that's the way everybody ought to be.
Well, I believe your family worked hard for your release from prison.
Sure they did, yeah. Well, that they did, and they did because they felt that the term of imprisonment was excessive. And indeed, that came to be the position of the United States government. Otherwise, I would still be in.
Do you think it was excessive?
Well, I think so. In terms of the other folks, you know, mine was four times as much. And it has been no secret made of it by John Sirica that the attempt was to break me through doing it that way. And he didn't have a prayer of doing that, and in fact did not. So that being the case, I didn't see much point to it.
What's the point of keeping anyone in prison if there's no longer information that can be gotten from them?
Well, it depends. If you're in prison and you talk to other prisoners, they will be amongst the first to tell you that we still have to have prisons because there are some people out there who are very dangerous to society. And they'll say, hey, I've got a mother, a wife, a sister, whatever out there, and I don't want some mad dog rapist being able to nail them anytime he wants to. There are some people like that who are dangerous and have to be kept away. By the same token, that doesn't mean that the conditions in which those persons are kept has to be inhumane. But there's an awful lot of people in prison who really don't belong there. I think if you've got a victimless crime or a crime against property, somebody takes somebody else's money, I think it would be a lot more sensible from the point of view of society if they had that individual living in a restricted environment such as a halfway house or something, working and paying back the money. I think the victim would feel a lot better at getting his money back or her money back rather than sitting there saying, yeah, he's in jail and I'm not getting my money back, but my taxes are it's $13,000 a year to keep him there. You know, and there's not much point to it because the individual isn't dangerous.
When you were an assistant DA, you organized a number of drug busts. And when you first arrived at the White House, one of your priorities was to try to stop the flow of drugs in the country. And I'm sure many of the people who were arrested, served long, some of them short, prison sentences because they were holding marijuana or LSD
I disagree with prison sentences for personal use of a drug like marijuana because there the only one who's being harmed is the individual himself or
herself.
Does this
represent a change in point of view?
No, I supported the revision of the New York law. I said that at one time, New York law was such that if you had a little bit more than a quarter of an ounce of pure sand in your hand and one marijuana seed in there, you had a felony possession. And I was amongst many who recognized that as a pretty ridiculous situation and moved to change it. On the other hand, however, I took the position, and I have not changed, that those who deal in drugs, and especially those who are in the business of what we would call harder drugs, be it cocaine, heroin, morphine, or any of those controlled substances, do constitute dangerous people because they are involved in the destruction of lives of children. Now, when it comes to marijuana, a dealer, I would say, is a danger because I'm aware of the effects of continued marijuana rather than just occasional experimental use on goal orientation and things like that, which is critical among youth. And so I would not put in jail the kid who happens to have gotten a hold of a joint. But I would look for people who are selling that stuff to children because they are harming those children.
Okay, let's get back to your sense of loyalty. You were very loyal to President Nixon at the time that you were working in the White House. What was it about Nixon that you felt deserved your loyalty?
Well, I would have felt the same way were I in the service of any president of the United States. One's president is one's commander-in-chief. Whether or not one is in the same political party, I would say that Richard Nixon had no greater claim upon my loyalty than would have had I been in the Army or in the government service during the reign of Franklin Roosevelt, with whom I disagree and was a different party. But he is the commander-in-chief, and so you serve him loyally, or you resign when you feel you cannot any longer do so, such as Mr. Vance just did, which was a very honorable thing for Mr. Vance to do. He resigned when he felt he could no longer support publicly the policies of his president.
Did you feel Nixon was a good president?
Yes, I think he was very, very good, very competent president. That happens to be the judgment of those in Europe and Asia and even in Africa right now, and I think ultimately will be the judgment of history in this country. And as a matter of fact, something interesting happened when I was in Detroit about 3 days ago. In preparation for a show very much like this one, Radio Call-In, the station, I guess the day before, polled its listening audience and said, you know, how many now, after these years have gone by and after thinking about it, would vote for Richard Nixon, could they vote for Richard Nixon for president tomorrow? 73% said yes, they would. And when that was delved into a little bit, it was because he's viewed as a very competent guy who really knew what he was doing. And the present apparent perception of Jimmy Carter is not that he's a bad guy or anything like that. Indeed, people think of him as a very good man in moral terms, religious terms, who has just found himself into a job in which he doesn't know what he's doing. And we're all suffering not because of any evil intent on the part of Jimmy Carter. Indeed, they all feel he probably prays daily for guidance. But unfortunately, he ain't getting any, and we're going down the tube.
You'd vote for Nixon again?
Oh, absolutely, in a hot minute.
Okay. When do you believe that a person is above the law? Is a person ever above the law?
No, a person is never above the law so long as one understands what the law is and certain maxims about the law. First of all, I believe that what Cicero said is correct. The good of the people is the chief law. Secondly, he says, laws are inoperative in war, and we know that that is a principle followed by no less a person than Abraham Lincoln. During the Civil War in his country, Abraham Lincoln suppressed probably our most cherished civil right, which is the writ of habeas corpus, the great writ we inherited from Great Britain. The question logically next comes, well, who's to say what's the good of the people? You know, you, Gordon Liddy? Well, certainly not. The person who is chargeable with that responsibility is the president, because he's the one who is elected by the people. And if you disagree with him, well, then you elect somebody else the next time around. That's the way it works. That's why when I would have certain suggestions, they would be nothing but suggestions and would never be acted upon unless they were approved by my superiors in the White House, because I was not at that high a level where I could arrogate to myself very serious decisions such as those I was involved with.
So if a president says, yes, I think it's a good idea to bug Democratic National Committee headquarters, or yes, I think it's a good idea to assassinate a person, then in that case it becomes as if it was legal because you've gotten the corroboration.
Well, doesn't become – we've got to distinguish here, because you're getting into a legal area and a technical area, and I think it's important for us to distinguish. I was engaged in two different kinds of work when I was at the White House. One was, in my judgment, legal and involved national security and not politics, and that was the activities of the Odessa Group when we were, for example, trying to determine whether Daniel Ellsberg was a romantic loner of the left or whether he was an agent of the KGB, something we thought might be true because in addition to turning over the massive McNamara study, all those confidential, highly classified, actually, documents to the New York Times, which, to its credit, did not print all of them because some of them were so hot. We learned, coincidentally, that a complete set was delivered to the Soviet embassy. So we didn't know what we were dealing with there, and that's what we were trying to find out. Now, that, in my judgment at that time, in the state of the law at the time, was clearly legal. On the other hand, when I was no longer with the Odessa Group and we were engaging in a political campaign and seeking political intelligence, clearly what was done was illegal, but not wrong, morally wrong. And there what we do is we distinguish between malum in se and malum prohibitum, and I think we ought to explain that. Malum in se means something evil in and of itself. And what do we mean by that? It takes no act of the legislature of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to instruct me that there are never any circumstances conceivable which would justify me molesting a little child, let us say. On the other hand, if I'm driving out in the country and it's flat and I can see for 20 miles and I come to an intersection and there's a stop sign and I go through it because there's nobody else around, I have violated the law because there's a statute that says don't do that. But for a statute saying thou shalt not go through a stop sign, it's a morally indifferent act. So I violated the law, but I've done nothing wrong. Now, the way I view it, when you engage in malum prohibitum, you violate the law. You must be prepared to accept the consequences if you're caught and not be heard to squeal or moan. But you haven't done anything evil. Now, what comes under the heading then of malum prohibitum and malum in se? When one comes to killing, homicide, it depends upon the totality of the circumstances. The Bible, translated correctly from the Aramaic, really does not say thou shalt not kill. It says thou shalt not do murder. And that's because murder is a technical term meaning, by definition, an unjustifiable homicide. However, I think everyone will agree that homicide can not only be justifiable, but can indeed be a moral obligation. Let's say one is in wartime and one is a soldier and engage in combat with the enemy. So what then? Well, reasonable people differ on these serious questions. I might believe something in good conscience is a justifiable homicide, and you might have very strong opinions to the contrary. Typical examples would be the debate that continues on capital punishment. There are people who say capital punishment constitutes murder. It's an unjustifiable homicide. There are many people who say we are murdering a quarter of a million babies a day through abortion. There are others who say, well, no, that's perfectly permissible. These are serious matters, and serious and responsible people disagree as to them. So I'm prepared for the fact that people may disagree with me, and it does not seem to me unusual that they might.
Okay, but with abortion and with capital punishment, there is finally a court that rules on whether something's legal and illegal. And while that's happening, most people live within the bounds of that law. Taking a life and extinguishing it individually is going beyond the law.
Let's take cases of abortion. I mean, before it was legalized, there was an awful lot of it because people thought it was right to do, and they did it anyway. And that's the point. If you're going to do that, be prepared to accept the consequences and don't snivel. And that's only the only message there.
Okay. One thing that you are considering doing, which is very applicable to what we're discussing now, is assassinating the columnist Jack Anderson.
Right.
What do you think he was doing that morally justified
assassinating
him?
Yeah, sure. There was no even thought of taking direct action against Jack Anderson. Even after he had exposed in his column one of our finest technical sources of intelligence abroad, which was the fact that we were listening in to the Soviet leaders, Brezhnev, Kosygin, and the rest of them, as they drove about in their Zis limousines in Moscow, talking to each other about all kinds of things over their phones. That blew that source. But when Howard Hunt came to us with the information from his principals in the White House, meaning high officials in the White House, that Anderson, two things. One, had just identified and exposed a human asset, a living intelligence source abroad, which Howard Hunt just recently narrowed down in talking about it to the Middle East, is where he says it was now. And that person had died, who was about to die under torture as a direct result thereof, and Anderson was expected to continue this line of conduct, and there was no other way to stop him, then direct action against him was indeed considered, and I suggested assassination as the appropriate means, and the other two agreed immediately, the other two being Howard Hunt and the expert on what was called, as Howard put it, the unorthodox application of chemical and medical knowledge, meaning assassination from the CIA. And we didn't use Anderson's name in this man's presence because he had no need to know.
In this country, we always point with pride to our free press, and many people in this country point to places like the Soviet Union and say, look what happens over there. If you wrote a story revealing something about the government, you'd be put in a prison camp.
Nobody thought to move against Anderson for writing a story against the government. It was strictly this business of jeopardizing the life of intelligence sources abroad. And as I said in my book, Will, were I back in that business with the Odessa Group or something like it under any administration, and were I sent to kill Philip Agee because of what he's doing, namely exposing the identities of CIA officers abroad, I would do so. And I think it's justified. I think he's asking for it. I'm surprised they haven't knocked him off already.
You were half expecting to be killed yourself, I think, afterward.
Yes, right. Yeah. And what I said was, I'll stand on whatever street corner you want. The reason for that was I didn't want somebody coming Sunday morning and poking a shotgun through my kitchen window, not only taking me out, but he takes out Mrs. Lydia and one or two of the kids. I said, you want to go that route? We'll go someplace quiet and we'll take care of it where we don't endanger innocent lives and taxpayers.
Do you think you would have had your counterpart killed if it was someone else who had organized the break-in and who had had someone like McCord?
I don't know. It would have depended. For example, I mean, I knew I wasn't going to talk, but I just figured that maybe my assurances wouldn't have been sufficient for them. If I knew me, I would have said those assurances were sufficient. If I knew someone else like John Dean, I'd say, kill him within the next 5 minutes because this man just cannot, will not, is constitutionally unable to withstand pressure, and he's going to turn into a rat and informer or whatever you want to do just as quickly as he can. And indeed, he did. So it depends on the individual.
Is that how you see Dean now, as a rat and an informer?
Well, rat is a prison term that I adopt for that, but he's essentially a weak and characterless person who's subject to pressure and will just go whichever way the pressure on him is.
He had stated that one of the reasons that he testified to the Watergate committee was that he felt his own guilt catching up with him. He was tired of lying, and he felt he had a moral responsibility to reveal the truth.
That's what he said. He in fact did so, however, in my opinion, to save his ass.
What would you think of a person who actually did feel that it was their moral responsibility to tell the truth and who felt that they were sucked into something like that and that, in fact, the actions were wrong?
You don't get sucked into something when you have the level of education and understanding of what is exactly what's going on that we all did. You must understand, John Dean recruited me for the Watergate operation. This was no big revelation to John Dean. It was his subordinate, Jack Caulfield, whose $500,000 plan, including bugging and all the rest, was rejected as inadequate, as a result of which he came to me. And for him to say, I got sucked into it, you believe that one, and I'll tell you the one about the Easter Bunny.
Okay. Did you feel that it was okay to break the law and bug the
committee? Oh, sure.
Committee?
I mean, that's done all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, in 63, when it was Republican National Headquarters, it was broken into, and it was Barry Goldwater who was bugged. It was Page 23 News, and that's where it belongs, Page 23. Indeed, a couple of weeks ago, the Democratic Headquarters was broken into in San Diego, and it's a small item in the paper in San Diego. I don't even think the other papers have picked it up, because this goes on all the time. That's politics. It's as American as mom and apple pie.
One of your this was just one of the ideas that was being worked on. There was something called Gemstone, which was
a lot of projects.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us some of the ones that you think would have been the most interesting or the most useful?
Well, the most useful was one of the first that we had to cut out because they just said we will not designate that amount of money to this project, and that was the microwave interception. And again, we certainly can't take credit for anything unusual there. The Soviet embassy is festooned with antennae. And what they do is intercept microwaves communications. Now, most people still think of telephone communications as going over wires most of the time. Well, actually, most of it no longer does. They're shot out in microwave beams. And when one is loaded, they're shunted. I mean, you might be calling Newark, New Jersey, and it might be going by way of Omaha. So you've got all of these different signals going on, and they take them all, record them all, and use computers to put them back together and to read all the conversations down in Washington. Well, what I wanted to do was the same thing with respect to the microwave communications between the aircraft of other candidates and the ground, or their buses and what have you. And that's perfectly doable, and indeed, McCord, to demonstrate the project, got some information from Robert Strauss, overhearing Robert Strauss's radio telephone from his limousine, and we put that in to demonstrate the kind of things we could get. That would have been an excellent source, but it is very expensive, if for no other reason than it required us to have chase aircraft. And by chase aircraft, I don't mean that, you know, we get on the tail like a fighter plane, but you have to be up in the air where you can pick these things up, and it was just too expensive to go.
What do you think you could have gotten if the Watergate break-in had worked?
Well, people misunderstood, I think, the purpose of it. They said, gee whiz, Larry O'Brien wasn't there half the time. You know, what's the point? And also they said, you know, McGovern was the candidate and McGovern wasn't going anywhere. What's the point? Well, first of all these plans were laid, nobody knew who the candidate was going to be. And indeed, the prime candidate at the time was Muskie, now Secretary of State, who was considered to be a potentially formidable candidate. And there was always in the back of the mind of those high in the Nixon White House that at any time Teddy Kennedy said, I want it, he could get it. And he was considered someone who would have been potentially a very formidable opponent. But when we went in there to put in, one, a room transformer, transmitter, and a telephone transmitter, the idea was not so much just to get what O'Brien might say in there when he was in there. But we knew that whoever the Democratic candidate would end up being from their convention, he would undoubtedly come back, and instead of his little headquarters that he'd been operating out of as a potential candidate, he would move into the DNC headquarters, his vast system of offices, and with our stuff already in place, we'd be able to read them from the word go. And also bear in mind that once a person is the candidate, they'd be surrounded by the Secret Service. It'd be a lot harder to get in there and do the job. So it made very good sense for us to do what we did when we did it.
I'd like to get back to the separation that you made between what's legally and what's morally wrong and what's legally and morally okay. Mm-hmm. You were talking also a little bit about drugs and how it's okay, you think, for someone to be smoking a joint.
Well, I don't think it's okay, but I don't think someone ought to be put in prison for what we call a mere possessory offense, as distinguished from a commercial transaction.
One of the things that you were considering doing when you were trying to monitor Daniel Ellsberg was to put LSD in his soup before a speech that he had to give.
Right, that had been approved from above as a technique to disorient him, right?
Now, where does that fit into in the spectrum of
legality
and morality?
Yeah, no problem with that either, because had Ellsberg been a political opponent, I would say that would have been wrong. Ellsberg was not a political opponent. Ellsberg was someone who was stealing and had stolen highly classified information. And when one does that, when one puts oneself in the posture of an enemy or an antagonist of the state, one really ought not to be surprised when the state strikes back. It's the same situation as the thing we had in the 60s. When you riot and burn and things of that sort, you ought not to be surprised when the National Guard is called out and you get yourself shot. You're asking for it. And I don't have any problems with that at all.
Okay, let's take these one by one. When you, G. Gordon Liddy, put acid in someone's soup, or when you consider attempting to assassinate someone, that is different than a person who has had a fair trial, which is the demands in this country. It's something we cherish. In one case, you're taking the law in your hands, and you are being the arbiter of what's right and what's wrong and what's legally correct and what's morally correct.
The difference
in another, it's an organized system with checks and balances in it, and either a jury or a judge. Is that correct for you to be the decider of that?
If I were a gas station attendant, your argument would make sense. But I was working for the President of the United States, and you see, it's the difference is, as I think I may have mentioned, Cicero said two things. The chief law is the good of the people, and laws are inoperative in war. Now, let's take two of those things. Who is to determine what is the good of the people? Well, certainly not I. The people did not elect me. And thus, without orders from someone who was, or for someone speaking for him, I would not and did not. That's point one. Second point is that laws are inoperative in war. And when we look back on the 60s through the rose-colored glasses of nostalgia, we are inclined to conjure up visions of, oh, young lady such as yourself in a long granny dress, maybe instead of wearing a horn-rimmed glass.
Begging your pardon, I never wore a long granny dress.
I say, such as yourself,
okay.
Not yourself. I'm not sure you were probably a tiny child in those days. That's 20 years ago. You may not even have been born. But in any event, and holding daisies in her hand, but what actually occurred was 125 cities went up. We had the National Guard and paratroopers called out to restore order. We had Mark Rudd saying, we must destroy this country that we all hate. You had the Math Center in Wisconsin blown up, father of two killed, bombing of the capital of the United States, 40 dead in Detroit, 21 in Watts. I mean, it just went on and on. That is, in my judgment, a state of civil war. And if it was permissible, and I think it was, for Abraham Lincoln to suppress the writ of habeas corpus, it certainly was permissible, as far as I'm concerned, for us to take what in other circumstances would have been extra-legal means in order to restore order.
Okay, let's get back to what you said a couple of minutes ago. Mm-hmm. You said that if you break certain laws, then you get what's coming to you. And mm-hmm. In an instance like in Kent State, people got what they deserved. Does one deserve to lose one's life for protesting what one considers to be
well,
an unjust
so you
war?
It depends on how you protest it. You know, if you stand there holding a daisy, no, I don't think so. But instead of holding a daisy, if you've got two-thirds gasoline, one-thirds diesel fuel with a rag hanging out the end, and you're throwing that and burning things up, if people are being killed by blowing up the Math Center, and the guy was, if you are shooting at police officers in Cleveland, as they were just because they happened to be police officers, you're doggone right, you better expect that that's a two-edged sword you have just picked up. And those who live by the sword must be prepared to die by it.
An enormously overwhelming majority of the students who were engaged in protests at the time were engaged in peaceful protests. And of all the acts of violence, probably about 99.5% of those acts of violence were doing things like throwing rocks through windows. Violence
and burning down buildings.
At property. Mm-hmm. Now, when we're comparing that to war, do you think that that's perhaps an unfair comparison?
No.
In war, you're talking about...
No, because they would say, gee, you know, if there had been somebody in there, well, I didn't know there was anybody in there. I'm sure the fellow who blew up the Math Center didn't realize that that father of two kids was in there. But he blew it up and the guy died. And that's the difference. I mean, if you're going to do things like that,
okay,
don't snivel.
If somebody did that, did that justify the taking of the students' lives in Kent State who didn't do that?
If you're down there and you're walking down the street and you see a bank robbery in process and there's a police shootout, you walk down there because you're curious or for whatever other reason. You know, that's a foolish act. It's a reckless act. And if you got to get hit either directly or by a ricochet, it's too bad. You know, I'm just not going to weep for you because you should have had better sense. Now, it's the same thing. You got two bunches of kids there, a smaller group but a significant group, burning, breaking, looting, carrying on, and then these others. Now, those others, if they had any sense, would stay away from that when they see there are armed troops right in that area. I mean, what did they think was going to happen? The troops are going to come up and kiss them and say, they're there, young fellow. You know, that's just stupidity, and stupidity is something which does not engender terribly much sympathy.
If one disagrees with the principles upon which the government is operating, if you think that that people are being killed in another part of the country by the soldiers of your own country for unjust reasons, what do you, Gordon Liddy, think the proper way to register that protest is?
Well, I would say vote out of office the people who sent in the troops, and if you are not prepared to restrict it to that, if you want to take more direct action, indeed, if you want to do anything that's illegal, fine, if that's within the scope of your conscience, but don't snivel to me if you get shot or something else. I mean, that's a risk you undertake.
Okay, I think I'd have the right to tell you that if you're sending in troops with guns to respond to people who are involved in civil disobedience that you're probably taking the wrong action.
You can say that, but if I'm the person who's chargeable with the government of the country, and you are taking that position while people are bombing and burning and looting, I'm the one who's just going to say to you, well, I disagree, and I'm the one whose job it is to do it, and I'm going to do it, and if you get caught in the middle, that's your fault, not mine.
Okay. You've told us that basically the people who died at Kent State got what they deserved, but on the other hand, you served for what was initially an 8-year sentence, only 4.5 years, and that was for bugging the DNC. Right. For violating the law on a very national scale. And
hardly a national scale. It was only one office.
Okay, so you think that the people on Kent State, in fact, deserve to be killed, but what I said was
they took a risk, a foolish risk, to put themselves in a very hazardous place. It's like walking along the edge of a cliff and falling off and then saying, gee, wow, you know, all I was doing was trying to view the scenery, and I got killed. Well, yeah, but it was kind of a foolish place to put yourself in the first place.
In the very last page of your book, when you're describing what happened when you got out of prison, there were about 6 cars of journalists following you, and you were trying very hard to avoid them. I guess you just didn't want to
They weren't trying to speak with me. They were there to photograph me, and I saw that it was a legitimate purpose, and I deliberately drove slowly and steadily and everything so that they get almost an hour's worth of photographs, which I thought was reasonable. And then when I thought that they were behaving unreasonably, in as much as I don't believe in being a victim, I sought to evade them.
You evaded them by driving, as you describe, about 70 miles an hour through city streets, through red lights. I'm wondering what you thought of that, since you think it's incorrect.
If I had been arrested for speeding, violating a red light or anything else like that, I think I would have been given a ticket. I would have deserved to receive the ticket. And if I was fine, I would have paid the fine, and I wouldn't be sniveling about it.
Uh-huh. What if you had killed me? What if I was you were... How do you know you would?
Because I'm a hell of a good driver, honey. This is the way I used to make my living.
Uh-huh. Well, say I was crossing the street.
I'm assuming you were crossing the street. I certainly wouldn't run over you on the sidewalk.
Uh-huh. So you're just too good. You didn't have to worry about that because you're too good.
I'm just very competent at what I do when I drive, yeah.
Okay. There's no such thing as an accident when you're real good.
Of course there's no such a thing as an accident.
But it wouldn't be your fault because you're good.
No, it wouldn't be the accident. If you don't have the incident, there is no fault attaching you because you're talking speculatively. There isn't anything that happened. Now, if I had run over somebody or something like that, I could see your point. But nobody was endangered because, in fact, nobody was endangered.
Okay, now I asked you earlier in this conversation if certain people are ever above the law. And what I'm interpreting from what you're saying now is that if you're really good at something, you can ignore the rules because those are for common people.
No.
If you believe
in what you're doing, in other words, if you want to do something that is a violation of the law, mm-hmm. you must anticipate that if you are caught, in other words, if the policeman came after me and caught me, that you must pay the consequences and you ought not snivel about it. I mean, I thought I made that point very clear.
Right, but
and
I'm
I agree.
And if rules, they wanted to give me... Rules, you're talking about rules as if they exist so that if you break them, you'll just get punished.
I'm talking about the distinction between malum prohibitum and malum in se. Mm. Malum prohibitum, it does not bother me to commit. I'm prepared when I do to accept the consequences of it. I don't do anything that's malum in se, something that's evil in
itself. Okay,
I'm
asking you if you think about the consequences of your actions on other people. You've been talking about the consequences on you if you violate a law. You may mm-hmm. go to prison, you may get fined, and you will accept that. What about the consequences of your act on other people?
Well, I'm assuming that when I act on other people that there are consequences to them. But what you're doing is postulating something that didn't occur. There wasn't any other person involved there. In other words, if you had a real thing to bring to me, perhaps I could address it better. But what you've got is speculation. I was there. You weren't there. There was no one endangered.
Right. I'm just saying you were lucky there wasn't.
No. If it had been a crowded street like downtown Philadelphia,
right.
Obviously I wouldn't have.
Okay.
But we were not in such an area. You see, that's the point. You really don't know what you're talking about. I know you're trying to make a point and trying to bring a hypothetical here.
I think the point is obvious when you're driving through any city street at 70 going through red lights. I think the point is obvious. Let's take something like the Watergate break-in. Mm. Now, that was something that you thought was okay, yes. And everybody does it. In fact, the consequences of that action, besides the arrests of the people who did it, was international embarrassment for this country.
Yeah, but the international embarrassment for this country is because of the foolish reaction within this country. The French thought we were crazy, and I don't blame them.
Okay. So that was just foolishness on the part of others.
Yeah, I mean, after all, the bulk, if you recall the era, the bulk of the press for a long time treated it as it deserves, and that is with, what is it, benign neglect. They didn't publish anything about it at all. It was really the product of the obsessive fear or what have you of Richard Nixon that I guess Ben Bradley and Catherine Graham had that caused this thing to be blown all out of proportion.
Okay. I'd like to hear a little bit about some of the things that you did to strengthen your will, which you describe in the book. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. For strengthening my will, primarily I used fire. Because I had a twofold effect. When I was a child, I happened by accident, because I didn't know what it was, to pick up a hot coal, and it burned me, and it scared me, and I was afraid of pain, and I was afraid of fire for that reason. And at first, what I wanted to do was get rid of the fear of pain and fire, and so I used fire and pain to overcome that, and then I simply used that as the same technique one would use when trying to strengthen physically an arm to increase the weights that one would lift. I increased the amount and duration of the fire until I reached the point of diminishing returns, which is where a serious injury would set in, and that seemed to me unreasonable, and so I didn't do it.
Did that work? Did that apply? I mean, if you can learn to resist that pain, does that work if you're under heavy cross-examination? Does that...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you are a psychologically strong person, then you can, in effect, as I did, for example, resist all three branches of the federal government if you have to. And if you're not, you won't be able to, as Dean was unable to.
You also tell a story about how you overcame your fear of rats. Could you tell us that?
Yeah. First thing I did, this again when I was a child, I would go down underneath the piers on the waterfront and try to confront the rats. And this didn't work very well because, first of all, rats swim very well and they would just jump off and swim away. And I remained fearful of them, less and less to be sure, but still I had residual dread. And finally, when my sister's cat killed one freshly, I recalled the fact that certain American Indian tribes used to consume the heart of an enemy that they consider to be courageous, to overcome the fear of that tribe. The African Zulus, I just learned in another program on this, in this city, used to consume the heart, the brains, and the genitalia for the same reason. It's apparently a multiracial thing. And so I cooked and consumed part of the rat. And thereafter, I had no fear of rats.
So that worked?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I'd like to invite you to call us now. Our phone number is 387-6660. My guest is G. Gordon Liddy, and he's here in Philadelphia on the occasion of the publication of his book, Will, in which he discusses his involvement in Watergate and talks a lot about his childhood, his role as an assistant DA. If you have any questions you'd like to ask, our number is 387-6660. We're at area code 215. Our phone lines are now open, and the number again is 387-6660. Gordon Liddy, do you feel at some point Americans will appreciate what you did when you were with the White House?
Oh, I don't know that I'm all that significant. I think that at some point Americans will realize that, Watergate was a tempest in a teapot, and the judgment of history on the Nixon administration, and Richard Nixon in particular, will be very close to what it is now in Europe, Asia, and Africa, and that is that he was a very competent president.
Okay. How do you measure yourself to other people in history? Is there someone who you compare yourself to?
No, I don't think I would rate status as an historical figure. I've never been a president or anything like that.
How would you like to be treated in textbooks when they're talking about...
Fairly.
What would fair be?
He did what he was supposed to do when he was supposed to do it, and he didn't do what he wasn't supposed to do when he wasn't supposed to do it.
How did you tell your children about your involvement? Did they find out years after, or did they know what the branches of government didn't? How much were you able to divulge to your family?
No, you don't. When you're in that line of work, you don't tell your family anything. Whatever they learned through the press, I guess, because I certainly never discussed the matter with them.
How do they feel about your involvement now?
I think they felt that I did what I was supposed to do when I was supposed to do it and didn't do what I wasn't supposed to do when I wasn't supposed to do it.
What would you do if one of your children became a pacifist?
Kick him in the ass.
Why?
Because he's committing suicide.
Okay. Let's take some phone calls now. My guest is G. Gordon Liddy, and our phone lines are open. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Richard Hofstadter's conception of paranoid style in American politics.
I'm afraid the only Hofstadter I know was a pretty girl in junior high school.
Oh, I'd like to know her, too. Hofstadter is an American history professor at Columbia University, and I think I can summarize this real briefly. I have his article in front of me, and he says the central image is that of a vast and sinister conspiracy, a gigantic yet subtle machinery of influence set in motion to undermine and destroy a way of life. The idea of paranoid style is the idea of a fear of conspiracy. One example of what it might be is if you look at the student protests in the 60s and immediately conclude that it must be the result of a massive KGB conspiracy or some other conspiracy designed to undermine the American way of life. Now, if that's clear enough, I would like to know if, in retrospect, you would attribute some of the actions of the Nixon administration to this paranoid style or a fear of conspiracy.
No, I agree with what the man said. I don't recall anybody ever thinking in the Nixon administration that student demonstrations or indeed even the riots and what have you were a result of the KGB. There may have been some speculation along those lines by people who are carrying on about the Trilateral Commission and that kind of persons who do subscribe to the conspiratorial view of history, but I certainly don't.
You don't. Do you think that any actions that the Nixon administration okayed for you to do were a result of a so-called fear of conspiracy?
No.
No, you don't? Do you think that the fear of conspiracy was functioning in the White House at the time that you worked for the White House?
Not from anything that I heard there. They were concerned that Ellsberg might be not a romantic loner of the left, but a member of the KGB, as a result of the fact that the McNamara study documents were delivered to the Soviet embassy. But I hardly think that fits into the category of Hofstadter's thesis.
All right, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Have a nice day. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to make a comment about Kent State, which was that some of the students who were killed or wounded were not even attending the rally, were simply walking on their way to classes. And recently, one of the soldiers in that National Guard has said that, in his opinion, that even then, the National Guard should not have been put on that campus in the first place. And I just wonder how Mr. Liddy would have felt if some of his children, while peacefully walking the campus, were killed.
Well, I would have certainly been sorry, one, that they were killed, and I would certainly have been sorry that I had not so equipped them that they were not so stupid as to walk into a combat zone like that. I think that would have been a foolish act.
They did not know that it was a combat zone.
Well, if they didn't see all those troops around there with rifles and what have you, then okay. But it's very hard for me to believe that those troops were not known to be there.
Well, so we are to assume that whenever National Guard troops around, it automatically means there's going to be gunfire.
Anytime you see somebody walking around with a loaded gun, you better be very, very careful because you don't know what's going to happen. They're not there for no reason at all, and just be very, very careful.
Right.
Do you want to ask anything else?
No, that's all. I just wanted to say that I think the whole thing was a tragedy, and that the person who spoke before showed that there was a conspiracy hysteria in this country, and that's why they were sent there. And I feel that Richard Nixon and company were largely responsible for that atmosphere.
Thanks very much for your phone call. Bye-bye. I think that what you're saying here is that it's basically impossible to protest peacefully.
No,
in this country.
Let
me just outline why I'm
peacefully.
Saying that, okay? Because in most of the student protests during the 60s and early 70s, no matter how peaceful the protest, at some point, either the city's police or the National Guard were called out and were armed either with weapons or with tear gas. And you're saying as soon as you see these people armed with weapons or tear gas, expect that violence is going to be done. So there's no way of reacting. If you protest, they're there, and if they're there, you expect violence. Therefore, if you protest peacefully, expect that violence will be done to you.
You're creating your own catch-22, and that isn't so. First of all, they don't usually send out armed troops when there is, in fact, a peaceful protest going on, you know, a bunch of people standing around under a banner singing, "We Shall Overcome." Tear gas may be present, but tear gas never killed anybody, and you're just constructing something that is not in accordance with reality or the facts.
Okay, what do you do? Stampede if you see the National Guard forming when you're
If you see the National Guard forming, if I were you, just leave. It's just stupid to hang around when you've got people with loaded guns.
How do you just leave in a huge crowd? It just seems like these are impossible situations or something.
No, it's very simple. You walk away. It isn't all that hard.
Mm-hmm. If you're in the middle of a crowd of thousands of people, how do you just walk away? And how does everybody just walk away?
You just move between them. I would, you know, move in an orderly fashion, because probably in a situation like that, there are people with bullhorns saying, "All right, you people, move down to this part of the street." I mean, you know, I've been in those areas, and the police are very competent in giving directions to the crowd as to what to do.
Okay, you don't think that that's escalating the situation, making it more inflammable?
No, because I think they're being reasonable.
Okay, let's take some more phone calls. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air. Hi, this is Fresh Air, you're on the air.
Hi, Terry. I have several comments that I would like to make, actually.
Go ahead.
Not questions.
Mm-hmm.
One, it's amazing how the man that was killed, and in that bombing of the building, I can't remember the name of the building, but he had a wife and two kids. But when Mr. Liddy considers killing Jack Anderson, those kind of things aren't mentioned. It seems to me to be a rather one-sided method of evaluation. And number two, those people in Kent State were going to school. I agree with the previous caller about, does this mean every time we see someone with a gun, we're supposed to hide in our basements? That's the kind of atmosphere that was developed in Nazi Germany. And number three, when people like Mr. Liddy make me feel like he should be exterminated because he is so dangerous to the way of life of our country, he makes me afraid because I don't want to feel that way. It's a sickness that I think Nixon did to this country most irreparable damage by making everybody say, "I'm going to get mine, and any way I can get it, I'll get it." Mr. Liddy frightens me. He frightens me very much.
Would you like to react to that?
Yeah. First of all, with respect to the comment, Anderson vis-a-vis the victim of the bombing and the math centers where it was in the University of Wisconsin, the difference, of course, is all important. Anderson is the wrongdoer, the person, according to the problem, who is responsible for the death of the U.S. intelligence source abroad, whereas the other individual is, by definition, innocent. He's just there. Two, Kent State, we have a, you know, I think we've already addressed that, the going to school issue. You and I have been through that, and I've already expressed myself on it. Item number three, the individual is afraid of me. Well, that's all right. I don't ask him to be afraid of me or not afraid of me. He's entitled to his reaction.
No, sir, I'm not afraid of you. I am afraid of what people like you do to this country.
Oh, okay.
You make me want to do the same kind of things that you do.
Well, let's hope you can control yourself.
Your end justifies the mean philosophy is not the philosophy that I was brought up to believe in this country.
Okay.
Our caller made a reference to the tactics used in Germany. Now, you, in your book, will discuss some of the things that you feel we should have learned from from Nazi Germany.
No, from Germany, not Nazi Germany.
If somebody disagrees with your philosophy, kill them.
from Germany.
You are the judge of that. No one else. You can be the judge of that, and because you're acting for the president, for some higher power. But then the president isn't responsible for those things because he didn't know they were happening. It's a real catch-22 if I ever heard one.
Well, you're putting words in my mouth that
you
weren't there, so...
You said before, sir, that you would only do that if you got the authority from a higher power.
Exactly.
But Nixon never knew anything about anything that you guys were doing, right?
I have no idea because I never spoke to him.
Well, that's what
I do is decline to speculate on something that I know nothing about, which is apparently a reservation you do not put upon yourself.
No, I'm sorry.
I did not draw any conclusions from that. I said that he said
indeed, you
he
did.
Never knew anything about what was going on.
Well, if that's what he said, that's what he said. Who am I to say differently?
Well,
I wasn't in conversation with him.
Without his approval.
Thank you. I'm going to try to straighten this out. Thanks very much for calling. Thanks for calling. I think what our caller is saying here is that on the one hand, you're saying that it's okay to go beyond certain laws or to act individually if you have the sanction of your president. But on the other hand, when
and
they say,
oh,
so
Malamin,
the president sanctioned it, you say, well, no, the president didn't know anything.
I haven't said the president didn't know anything. I have said I did not know what the president knew or did not know.
So
because
if you
I
don't
was
know
not
what
at
he
the
knew,
level.
Then he couldn't have sanctioned it.
He didn't sanction it, and it didn't happen. That's the point.
Okay. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
I'm on the air?
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Liddy, welcome to Philadelphia.
I'm delighted to be here.
Okay. I was wondering if you shed some light on the nature of, like, a multinational corporation. When I have mine as GM, and a specific light on how to squeeze $50 out of them that they owe me. Well, you know.
I would go to small claims court and file a suit.
Okay.
Thank you for calling. I don't understand your question. Hello, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes. I'd like to ask Mr. Liddy. He said about John Dean that he was essentially weak. Well, assuming that everything that Richard Nixon has said about his knowledge of Watergate is true, how would he judge Richard Nixon's conduct in that in terms of strong or weak character? And my second question, is there any leader currently in power in the world whom he admires?
I consider Richard Nixon to have an excellent character. I don't see that that's related to John Dean's in any way, and my views of Mr. Nixon are prescind from those of whatever John Dean's are. World leaders today, yes, I think Margaret Thatcher's excellent.
I see. Oh, okay, may I ask one more question?
Yeah.
It seems your approach, I haven't read your book or read anything about it, but the will, the importance of the will. Is this something that you feel is just important to you in your business or what your business was, or do you apply it to other areas of?
No, I think that those humans amongst us who are strong-willed tend to prevail, and those who are weak-willed tend not to. I would say that. I would best express my philosophy in that regard as social Darwinism.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. Bye-bye. My guest is G. Gordon Liddy. If you're just joining us, our phone lines are open. If you'd like to call us, we're at 387-6660. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Liddy.
Speaking.
I was the first caller I asked you about paranoid style and fear.
Oh, yes, Mr. Hofstadter's friend.
I have another question
okay.
for you. I was wondering if you consider yourself in the light of being a continuation in the American vigilante tradition.
No, the vigilantes did not work for the government of the area in which they operated, which I believe began in San Francisco. I'm not sure.
No, it didn't really begin in San Francisco, but they did, in a sense, work for the government. They were supported by some presidents and some governors, and they operated outside of the law in their own effort to control social problems.
Okay, well, my answer to your question is no, because, you know, they were not government operatives by common definition.
All right. But, okay, then do you consider yourself as being a vigilante?
No.
Okay, thanks for calling. We're going to take some more phone calls. Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Liddy.
Speaking.
I'd just like to say that I was really offended by you calling Terry Gross honey, And in fact, overall, I'm really disgusted by the lack of respect that you seem to have for people. It seems like you're respecting authority and government instead of people. And I'd like to ask you to apologize to Terry for calling her that.
No, I won't apologize, but I do appreciate your sharing with us your view.
Do you agree with it?
No, I don't.
Okay, well, I'd just like to say that
I think you're overly sensitive. I think the ERA has probably exacerbated your sensibilities to those sort of things.
Do you think that the ERA should be passed?
No.
How come?
Because I think, first of all, it is unnecessary. And secondly, I think that it will end up in a net loss to women. And my wife, for example, is dead set against it. She says that there are certain protections that women have currently under the law that they would lose. I certainly don't believe that women ought to be in combat. I think that's no place for them at all. And I oppose the ERA and hope that it will never become the law of the land.
Women could be enlisted into the armed forces with or without the ERA.
Well, they could be enlisted, yes, but I don't think they could be drafted.
Legally, they could be drafted with or without the ERA.
That's right.
There's no laws that say that women can't be drafted.
Well, I think if you try to get that through Congress, you will fail.
Through Congress, but through the courts.
Well, there's no such provision now, and I don't think you'd get it through the Congress.
Okay, but again, that's not dependent on the ERA. That's a false issue.
No, it isn't, because if ERA goes in, then I think that there's no way that it could be resisted.
Okay.
I think it could be resisted effectively now.
Do you have any other questions you want to ask?
No, that's all I wanted to say.
Okay, thanks a lot for calling.
Sure.
Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Hi, I have a question for Mr. Liddy.
Mm-hmm.
You said earlier, Terry, you asked him a question, what would he do if his son said he wanted to become a pacifist?
Right.
And the response immediately was, I'd kick him in the ass. And you had asked him why, and you said because he felt he'd be committing suicide. Now, my question is, quite simply, suppose his son accepted the consequence of that act. How would you feel about it then?
I'd think he was rather stupid, and I'd be very disappointed in him.
Well, that's a little incongruous to what you've been saying, because if I read what you've been saying all this afternoon correctly, you're saying that if you accept the consequence of what you do, then it's okay.
Yeah, that doesn't mean that I agree with what anybody else is doing. The mere fact that I will accede to your right to do something under certain circumstances doesn't mean that I agree with the proposition you will espouse.
But you will.
I mean, that's a non sequitur.
If he accepts the consequence of his act, then it's all right to do that, regardless of what the act is.
It's morally all right to do it, but it can still be a stupid thing to do.
Okay, then that answers my question. May I ask another question?
Go ahead.
I was just kind of curious. You seem like a very interesting person and a man of action. I was kind of wondering what you would have advised the president to do in Iran.
The first thing he ought to have done was to accept the recommendation on the day that the terrorists took the prisoners of the Pentagon, when American intelligence told them that the Ayatollah Khomeini was not in Tehran but in Qom. And they said, if we can send the commandos in now, we can grab the Ayatollah and arrange a swap. I think that would have worked, and I think he should have done that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon, Mr. Liddy.
Good afternoon.
I'd like to ask you back to your distinction between acts that are illegal but may or may not be morally correct. Could you please repeat those two Latin terms for me?
Malum in se, three words, and malum prohibitum, two words.
Now, the second term, I believe, is the one where you say an act is always morally incorrect, intrinsically morally wrong.
No, malum in se. That means evil in and of itself.
Okay, could you give me an example of that, please?
Yes. I can think of no circumstance which would justify my molesting a child.
Okay. Now, I'd like to make a couple points, leaving aside your example. We could say, for instance, our speeding example, that there are circumstances when speeding is justifiable. For instance, if my mother is sick and I have to rush her to the hospital. We agree that there are circumstances where killing, as unfortunate and as distasteful as we may say, is justifiable. The question comes that just because we say that in certain instances these acts are justifiable, they are not absolutely morally, categorically, forever and ever wrong, are they justifiable in the context in whence they were committed?
Well, that's always the question, isn't it?
Yes, that really is the question. And I think you were tending to avoid that. Because just because we can say that an act is permissible in some conceivable hypothetical context, that doesn't mean it was permissible in a context in whence it was committed.
Well, I never made that point, but if...
Now I return to a couple incidents. Putting the LSD in Mr. Ellsberg's soup. Why and how do you find that act, which we would say would be illegal, in the context that you committed it, how can you find that morally justifiable?
It wasn't committed. It wasn't committed.
All right.
Not because it wasn't approved, but because the lead time ran out.
Okay, well, let us say that you committed the act. How could you consider that?
Ellsberg had taken a position of attacking the state, and I was acting for the state.
But I don't think that was your responsibility, Mr. Liddy. It seems to me that you were usurping the function of the courts. That is the court's responsibility to determine whether someone is attacking the state, acting in an illegal fashion, and give out punishment appropriately and accordingly.
Well, I agree that the courts are the normal delivery system of that sort of thing, yes, but sometimes there isn't time. Sometimes the state simply acts outside of the courts. There had been for a long period of time, for example, a history of the state doing exactly that in connection with search and seizure. That law changed in 1972, coincidentally. But it is just not a universal. What the proposition you espouse is just happens not to be a universal, in fact.
So that you're saying that the idea...